Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another great show here of Beyond the Cover. I'm one of your hosts, John Robin. Of course, I'm here with my good friend Jeff Ayers. Jeff, how you doing?
Doing great. Happy belated Halloween.
That's true, but it's always Halloween because I love candy, so I just consider it trick or treat every day. That's what I like to do. We are going to be joined here, hopefully, very soon with best-selling author Lincoln Child. Of course, he is half of the Preston and Child writing team of the very famous Pendergast novels. He has his own book out by his by himself called The Forgotten Room, and Preston and Child, of course, have their own books out, their own book out also. So we're going to try to get into a little bit of that with him, which will be interesting. We're just waiting for him to call in. Hopefully he didn't, with the time change or whatever. Sometimes people get mixed up with that, but we'll see what we can do. And if we don't have him on, we'll get him back like we always do. We always have him on sooner or later, like we did Nelson DeMille. And, you know, we got some big guests coming up, too. Jeff, why don't you say who you get to interview next week for the show that we're going to be able to play?
Well, because of circumstances with the holidays and all that other stuff, I get to interview without you, and I'm sorry about that. We're going to do Robert Crace, and we're going to do Craig Johnson.
Yes,
Craig. And I'm really excited about that. Craig Johnson's Longmire, and
yes,
Robert Crace does the Elvis Cole novels, and they are amazing.
Yes, so that's going to be two great interviews. And we'll play those on the air when they're done, and that'll be fun to be able to listen to. We were going to have a special Robert Crace show next week, but he can't do it, so we're going to interview him instead, which is going to be interesting. It'll be fun.
Oh, yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And then we've got a couple other great shows lined up for until the end of the month. And then I think we're taking December off. Is that correct, sir?
Yeah, we're going to take a lot of December off. And then in February, don't we have a Michael Connelly sighting coming on the horizon? I do believe there's a Michael Connelly sighting coming.
I think you would be correct.
Yeah.
Yes,
so a lot of big guests coming on the show here, which is fascinating. It's great.
Yeah, definitely looking forward to that. And I'm guessing Lincoln put us in his forgotten room.
Could have. Like I said, sometimes, you know, with the time change and some people, you know, they don't, some people actually, I've had people that have talked to me and they're like, oh, so, and they're in New York and they're like, okay, so it's 7:30, it's 7:30 your time, so I need to call in at 4:30 my time. And I'm like, yeah, no, you got that backwards. You're actually going to call in at 10:30 your time. So I who knows? And maybe, you know, maybe he forgot. Maybe there's an emergency. You just never know. I mean, whatever it is, and we'll have him back on. You know, he said yes once. I'm sure he'll say yes again. We couldn't have scared him off because he hasn't been on the show yet. So that's a good thing. But
or maybe he has heard about our show. But anyway.
Oh, that's true. Well, we shouldn't have sent him the link. why don't we just get into letting us kind of know maybe what you're reading right now, Jeff, and then we'll kind of work it from there. Maybe we just work backwards.
All right. Well, that sounds like a plan. I just read the James Rollins. He has a novel out called The Bone Labyrinth. I take that back. It's coming out at the end of December, but I've already read it and it's terrific.
James
and he has an
one.
Ebook short story that's out now called Midnight Watch.
And James is another one who's going to be on the show later this month.
That's correct. And Midnight Watch is a wonderful, I want to say amuse-bouche. You know, I've been watching too much Top Chef. It's a nice sort of, gives you a nice little tasty bite and hints at what's to come with the novel. And it's the novel itself, Bone Labyrinth, is terrific. It's it reminded me a lot of early Michael Crichton, you know, with the really heavy science and interesting things going on.
Nice.
Yeah. And I'm also reading, I'm almost done with this. It's the new Pneumophiles from Clive Cussler and Graham Brown.
Oh,
and it's
okay.
called The Pharaoh's Secret.
The
and,
Pharaoh's
you know,
Secret.
You can't go wrong when you've got Clive Cussler in your hands. That's all there is to it. They're just, you know what you're going to get, and they're great. They're fun.
That's true.
Just, yeah. So this one is just, you know, the history and the action. I love it. Kurt Austin's
but
cool.
Let's not kid people. This is going to be Graham Brown's going to be writing this book, just so people
oh,
know.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Yeah.
It, you know. And I got to say, I like Graham Brown's writing style. His novels he's written himself I've liked. And I've honestly feel that he's done a nice job picking up on these pneumophiles from someone you know, Paul Kiprikos.
Oh, is that the Paul Kiprikos that Suspense Publishing publishes? Yes, it is.
Oh, I didn't realize
yeah,
that.
Paul, yeah. Yeah. You know, because, you know, Paul put out some great books, his Sox series. His latest one, of course, was like 25 years after Cool Blue Tomb was done, was The Gray Lady, which was an original. You know, we published that one about a year or so ago. Then he has his Matt Hawkins series, which is The Emerald Scepter. So, you know, Paul's still writing. I don't. The next one is tentatively called Midas Gold, but I don't know if that's going to stick. And that book's going to be another Matt Hawkins. He's working on another Sox book. So he's mid-70s, and he's still churning it along. He's loving it. He's, like, revised after we kind of got himself out in the ebook and get himself going. He's kind of revived himself. He's like a whole new guy because he was almost done writing because of how publishing was going, and he's part of that older regime that still is like, if I'm not in a bookstore, I'm not an author. And we finally had to change him to that when his books finally got with Amazon. And now he's like, wow, I'm still making this much money off of these books that are 25 years old. Maybe there's something to this ebook phenomenon. And it's like, yeah, it is. And I was, now, I would let you know, this weekend I was at a convention called the 805 Writers Conference here in Ventura. And I was on a panel yesterday with Paul Bishop and Craig Robertson, and it was the three of us. And I don't know if you know Paul Bishop. He's an ex-LAPD guy, but he goes around and he helps police forces with interrogations and, you know, like how to interrogate somebody. So it's kind of when he tells you that and you start talking to him, you're kind of on guard. Like, is he going to start like looking at me? Like, you almost wonder if he's like that guy that was on that show. What was it? Lie to Me. You're like,
oh,
wondering, like, is he reading me that way? Or, you know, it's just kind of creepy. And then, of course, Craig, he's a Scottish writer, so he's from Scotland. So he writes crime fiction. It was a great time. And, you know, this was the only time, and this is no lie, it was an hour panel. The moderator said, this is who everybody is. And she goes, why don't we start down at it when I was first? And she goes, and, you know, kind of just start talking about, you know, like what you do and this and that. That was the last thing she said the whole time until there was 10 minutes left in the panel. And she goes, so are there any questions from the audience? Because the three of us just went, and that was it. She literally didn't say another word until that time. But we
nice.
Had people cracking up, and it was fun. And we were there. We took I was there on Saturday, and Shannon and I were there on Saturday, and there were three people who pitched to us. And I just got to say, for authors that are listening to the show, I have to let you know that when you're pitching to a publisher or an agent, please, make sure that you go in with this is a yes question. And if it's not going to be a yes question or an answer to, you're not going to say yes to this question, then do not pitch your book. It's when they say, so, have you had it edited? If that answer is going to be no, do not pitch to anybody. Because they then think, like I think, you're way too ahead of the game, and I know that you're very excited, but we want to see stuff that's already been edited and finished, and you've already done all that. I don't want to see stuff that it's like, well, no, not yet, but, you know, I'm looking at it, and it's like, yeah, you're just going to come off wrong, and it's going to have a bad first impression, and it's not really what you want to see. So I just, you know, just know that right off the bat.
Why would someone not give you something that they believe is ready to be published? I don't understand that.
I got the synopsis. I got all three synopses, and I got like 7 pages, first 7 or 10 pages of everybody's manuscript, except for one author. We only did 3 people because it's not a very big conference. So the first person who came in, I just got her synopsis. She sat down, and she was literally pitching me a book off of a synopsis that she has not written one word on yet.
Ugh.
And I'm like, okay, you got quite a bit of work to do. First of all, she had no idea who her character name was. She didn't know what her character name was. Her main character, the main bad guy, she didn't have a name for him yet. She was way early. Now, she was a very nice lady. We had a very good conversation. I gave her some tips and some pointers, and I hope it comes out right because the premise is good. But that's way too early, and I'm just going to let you know. I mean, I'm a very nice guy. I mean, you might not think I'm a nice guy, but I'm very nice. And I won't hold that against her. Yeah, I mean, I won't hold that against her, but a lot of agents will. And if she writes back to some of those agents and, you know, she sits there and goes, hey, this is who I am, they're going to be like, yeah, but I'm out. I'm done. You know, that's just, they're just, you know what I mean? They're just going to be done. They're going to be out.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, you got to really, really, really make sure that you have everything ready to roll, because you're just going to be wasting people's time. So I just wanted to let you know. But it was a nice conference. It was a little small, but it wasn't bad. I did have one lady come up to me, and she goes, would you speak to my group? And I told her I would. You know, no problem. I don't know what the topic's going to be about, but, you know, I talk about anything for an hour. What the hell? I mean, I told her, I said, yeah, no problem. I said, just give me a topic, or I'll fake it like I have been. And,
yeah, people, you know, listeners to our show have already figured that out.
Oh, well, yeah, that's true. But, you know, I mean, I'll do that, and that's okay. But, yeah, I mean, and you know the situation, too, is that when you're ready to pitch, you're doing your thing, man, you gotta be ready to go on that. And that's just – and take the criticism coming from a place of love. It's not coming from a place of hate. We want to see every author – regardless of if you publish with us or if you go with someone else, we want to see every author fulfill whatever success dreams they have. We want that to happen. And
that's
so
right.
We're trying to help you be a better writer. We're not trying to kill your story. We're not trying to kill your dreams. We're not trying to tell you you can't do it, because I think that everybody has the ability to write. As long as you read a lot, you've seen all the words on the page. I mean, you know how to, you just got to put them together. I think everybody has the ability to write. I think some people just need a little bit of confidence, a little bit of push, a little bit of nudge to kind of get there. And I think that that's what that is. I mean, you've been through a lot of editing processes. I mean, you don't take it seriously, do you?
No, not at all. And I take it as these people are making comments to try and make the book better. And why would I not want the book to be better and be the best it can be? So,
yeah,
of course,
I mean,
they'll take that to heart. I might not agree with everything, but certainly it means, you know, especially if 3 different people are telling me the same exact thing, I better look at it.
Right. I mean, maybe you want to start off the book, you know, with a chase scene, and maybe one agent is like, oh, you know what, I think you should maybe start the book off there. And you're like, well, I don't agree. I'm going to start it off with that. Point, you know, here's a case in point. Not everybody is correct. And Paul Kempercos wrote The Emerald Scepter. His very beginning scene starts off, and it's an action scene, and there's stuff in it, and or it's, that's not an action scene per se. It's kind of the history and the setup and stuff. Well, before he gave the book to us, he had it out with his agent, and they were shopping it. Unbeknownst to him, they cut that whole first part out and started it with an action scene and then tried to sell the book, and no one bought it. And then we found out with Shannon and I, he came back and he goes, well, I found out that they were doing this and this, and, you know, I thought that they knew what they were doing. And we're like, no, you're not this kind of writer. You're a Clive Cussler kind of writer. You need to have that backstory in there. That's the important part. And all of a sudden, he put it in there. He felt good, and everything was great. And bam, Amazon bought it. There it is. So
yeah.
Not everybody's right all the time. Sometimes the author is correct. But it's, you know, those are different kinds of things as far as, you know, the biggest thing is you're missing dates or you have things that are wrong or incorrect and you have, you know, you're trying to, one of the things I talked about was if you're going to set a character in Britain, please make sure that you get the language right. If they say the word gray, write it EY, not AY. You know, these are kind of things that you have to know. Have to know, you know, what fish and chips is. You know, things are, you know, it's the underground, it's not the subway. Just little things. So I said, you need to make sure you get those things right.
Because if the reader stops for a second and goes, wait a minute, that's not right, you've lost them for good.
Yeah, that's true. And you've cheated them. And that's one of the biggest no-nos you could possibly do as an author is cheat your reader.
Yep. I agree with you.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, there's some other cool books that are coming out, too, I noticed. Have you seen... I haven't even read it. I don't even know if I get his books anymore. It's Grisham, the Rogue Warrior.
Oh, yeah. I reviewed that for AP.
How was it, honestly?
It was actually pretty good. Though, as I said in my review, he's not really a rogue lawyer. He's more just someone pursuing justice. Rogue gives the hint of him being sort of, you know, against the mainstream, and he wasn't at all. But it was still a good book. And it's also a collection of short stories disguised as a novel. But it's still, you know, if you
really
like John Grisham, you're going to like it.
Which John Grisham?
Yeah.
Because there's, you know, let's face it, there's young John Grisham with the Firm and the Pelican Brief, and then things kind of changed into a different style. So depends on which John Grisham I guess you like, right?
Yes. That's true. But I think he's such a mainstay now that people will pick up his books just to see his name.
Yeah. What about, and then Stephen King's coming out now with another one, The Bazaar of Bad Dreams and Stories.
It's short stories.
Collection of short stories. I haven't gotten that one yet either. I'm going to have to figure out about that one. Did you get it?
Yeah. What?
You got it?
You should be getting all these things. What's going on?
I don't know. Maybe I did. I just haven't looked. Dude, we get like 10,000 books. I haven't gone in my freaking room to look at them, so I don't know. You get about as many as I do, probably. I mean, you get a shitload of them, too.
Yeah, we call it Christmas in our house every day.
I know. I figure you'll check and see.
Actually, the only packages today were for my wife, and she goes, wait a minute, where are your books? So I said, I don't know. What's going on?
She's like, maybe I threw them away. Now, okay, here's an author that I absolutely, when she was first coming out, I loved her stuff. I used to listen to it on audio. She had one of the best villains that I've ever seen, and she kept them going in three books, which I really loved because it was great to see kind of the villain get away with it and then have to kind of, you know, get it going. Kind of Patterson did that with his Sanjay guy, which I think was fabulous too. I kind of like that. Stephen James did it with one of his villains. But I think it's kind of the end of the road for this character. Not necessarily this author, maybe, unless this is all she's got left. But Patricia Cornwell and her latest Scarpetta book, Depraved Heart. I don't know, man. Did you read it?
I have a confession about Patricia Cornwell.
You secretly love her.
I loved her books in the beginning. Loved them.
Body Farm, and Potter's Field. Oh, my God, that shit was so great.
They were fantastic. And then I don't know what happened, but I actually tried reading her previous book last year, and I couldn't get through it because I kept falling asleep.
And that's shocking because you read a book in like 3.5 hours, which means you must be really falling asleep.
It was a joke in the household. They'd find me asleep in the chair, and they'd go, Dad, are you reading that book again? And they'd see it in my lap. Like, yeah, I am.
You know, my jump the shark moment for this series was when her niece, Lucy, started becoming super genius. That's when I was done.
For me, it was when her boyfriend died and then came back. And I can't remember.
I don't even know if I got that far. Did I get that far?
It was, I can't remember his name now. She's married to him.
Oh, she's married to him now, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
but
she,
all I could
I
think
mean,
of was, okay, so you faked your death to stay away from her, and now you're okay? And it was very confusing, and I'm sure people who are Patricia Cornwell fans can yell at both of us, but...
whatever, they can... But you know what? Why don't they be honest? Because, I mean, when you go back and look at, like, From Potter's Field, Point of Origin, The Body Farm, all that remains... I mean, when you start looking at those books, those were absolute great classics. I think Black Notice was when I was like, I'm out. I think that was the one that put me kind of over. Dude, it's 23 books now into the series. 23 freaking books.
Now, did you try to read the new one?
No, I've not. I have it.
Right.
I saved
okay,
all of
I
books
saw that it had
because,
to do about Lucy
you know.
Again, so.
Oh, God. See, that's when I'm out, man. I can't handle
yeah.
the Lucy thing. You know, I love, I mean, I think it's, I think the guy's name, if you remember reading way back then, Leland Gaunt, I believe, was the villain's name. Leland, it was either Gaunt or Gaunt or Gaunt or something like that.
I think you were right
that
with Gaunt.
Yeah, and he was like in it for like three books, and he was scary as hell, and I loved him. And I hate it when good authors lose their way, and they've just become a slave to their character. I will say that I ran into an author this weekend at the 805 Writers Conference we happen to be talking, and I won't say who they are because if they want to say it, they can. Well, they kind of said it publicly. And I said, okay, I'll say it. So Paul Bishop was talking about how he cannot read Lee Child, and he said, I stopped reading Lee Child after his very first book. He goes, because the one thing that I can't stand in books are coincidences. He goes, and when you're telling me that this rogue guy happens to get off of a bus in a very, very small town, and just by chance, all this stuff happens, and his ex-wife is there, and it's all this coincidence. He goes, I'm out. He goes, I can't handle coincidences. And he goes, and everything that he writes is like, everything is like a coincidence. It just happens to happen to him every single time. And I guess that, and it resonated, and I was like, that is so freaking true. And Shannon has said that a lot with the editing process of some of our authors. It's like, look, you can't all of a sudden walk into your house and have it sit there, whatever you're looking for. Or remember the movie Sahara when Matthew McConaughey and Steve Zahn and they're fighting in the desert and all of a sudden they're trying to blow up something and they just so happen to blow up the one spot and then the fucking ship that they're looking for appears. It's like, really?
Yeah.
I mean, so it was so true because he's a mega author, what? And he goes, but everything in his book is a coincidence. And he goes, I don't like it. And I was like, and I started thinking, I go, that is so flipping true. I don't know what you think about it, but it's like, you know, he is a mega author, but is he a mega writer?
Most authors can't do coincidence well, but for some reason I feel like he does. And so I can suspend my disbelief and just go with it when it comes to him. And I don't know why it is. And I've tried to figure out why Lee Child can do that to me. Because other mm-hmm. authors, when they try it, it doesn't work. But he can do it.
Maybe. I mean, I guess... but I don't know. I would love to know
how he can pull it off for me.
Maybe Reacher is just that such a dynamic character that you don't really care how he got into the situation, just that he's in another situation. You know, it's kind of like James Bond to a point. You know, no matter what situation, no matter what it is, that James Bond gets into, he's going to make it out alive and he's going to capture the person. But you still go to the movies and you still watch the movies because I don't think you really care, even though you already know the ending. He gets the girl, he captures the bad guy, and he gets through a bunch of crap that he should have died in. But it's the same formula. And I tell you what, I'm going to go watch Spectre when it comes out.
Oh, I'm definitely looking forward to it.
Yeah, I already know how it ends, but I'm going to watch it. But I do get old, and I think it just gets old because I'm just sick of seeing. You know, sometimes I get tired of reading the same thing over and over. But a lot of people like to read the same thing over and over because they know that when they're spending their $12.99 or whatever on a book, they know what they're going to get. And if they don't get it, then they're going to be upset if he wants to try to change tune and do something else. And then maybe that's when they get upset. But if they get the same standard formula book that keeps going on, then they're going to be happy with it. And they're going to say, yay, we got it. You know, he came off, he fixed it, he did this, he saved the girl, he gets this, and everything's all better.
Let me ask you a question then, since we're talking about this sort of thing. Tess Gerritsen, her new novel, Playing with Fire, is not a Rosalie Niles novel, and it's not even really a thriller. It is the story of essentially a violin and a woman trying to sort of track down the history of this violin. Mm-hmm. And it's unlike things you would expect from her, but it's also an amazing book. And so if you're a fan of it, so I'm asking if you're a friend of, if you like the author and enjoy reading their stuff, when they completely do something that's unexpected, does that bother you?
Are you reading my letter from the editors? Because I talked about this a couple months ago in the magazine. Mm-hmm. I forget how long ago it was. And it was, you need to trust your author. And I love Tess Gerritsen. And I love the things that she writes. Some of the Rosalie and Isles, no, I'm not a big fan of. And that's fine. I don't have to be a fan of everything. I mean, I love the group Rush, but I don't like every one of their albums, for crying out loud. So when they do something like this, that's what I always say. You know what? She writes great books. She has a great series going on. You know, she knows how to do characters. She knows how to do, I guess you want to say, whether it's backstory or, you know, she knows how to build a story. So I'm going to trust that whatever she gives me that's off the beaten path is going to be good. Because tell me that Sandra Brown didn't hit out of the park with Rainwater. Tell me that James Lee Burke didn't hit out of the park with Wayfaring Stranger. You know, tell me that, you know, these guys, you know, that when they kind of jump off the kilter a little bit, haven't hit out of the park. Would you have ever expected Stephen King to write Shawshank Redemption?
No. And that's
right.
One of his best books.
Would you have ever expected Stephen King to write Stand By Me?
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
So if you love him as an author and you love what he does, then if he does decide, and if Lee Child or Patricia Cornwell or Janet Ivanovich or whoever else has written 20 books within the same character, James Patterson, and they decide to write something off the beaten path that's a little different than what they write, but you love their stuff, why wouldn't you trust them? Why wouldn't you trust them to give you a good story? So I love it. I think that they need to explore. I think they need to do this for themselves, to maybe kick themselves fresh, to keep themselves out of that way of being a cookie-cutter author, to keep the stories coming. So I like when they do it. I think it's great. I think it's wonderful when they do it.
Another one that came to my mind was David Baldacci. He's got,
mm-hmm.
you know, so many series going on. And my personal favorite book of his is Wish You Well, which was completely unexpected. And,
yeah, I mean,
you know, a family saga in Virginia.
I mean, the one thing that I think is so saturated right now, I mean, first it was vampires, then it was zombies. Right now, I am so saturated and so freaking tired of military political thrillers that I can just vomit all over a book when I see it. I hate them. I can't stand them right now. I'm so tired of SEAL teams. I'm tired of these people going after ISIS or a terrorist group, or this person's blowing up this and this person's blowing up this. I can't stand it, dude. I'm out. I'm done for a while. It's like listening to AC/DC Back in Black. I can't do it right now. I can't listen to Stairway to Heaven. I mean, I got to take some time. So when I see military political thriller, and it could be a great author, you know, we could have Brad Taylor, or like a David Baldacci or a Brad Thor. I can't pick up the book because I just can't stand, because I already know what I'm going to get, and I can't stand it. I got to get off something else. I got to get something else in me. You know, I just have to.
I review a lot of those, and it's really hard, I would think, especially if you're writing them. How do you distinguish yourself from someone else? Because there are so many authors who do it well. And what makes your novel stand out? You know, oh, I was over there. Well, so are these other 500 authors who are writing these books right now.
Yeah.
You gotta give it something different. There's now a SEAL Team 666, and it's pretty much,
oh,
you know,
God,
fighting zombies. And
I mean,
you gotta wonder about this.
Enough
stuff
already, man. I mean, it's enough already. We have one, you know, one of our authors, Joseph Vidal, he's the only one. He has his Danforth series, and he has Matilda, you know, he has his military books, but he also wrote Borderline, which was his last book, which was a straight mystery. And his next Danforth book, which is book 5, Death Ship, is out now. It's on pre-order, and that's his political thriller stuff that he writes. But he's written other stuff. He gets away. You know, like I said, he just wrote Borderline. He wrote Shell Game, which was a financial kind of thriller with the creepiest villain you'll ever read in your entire life. That has it in there. So if you haven't read that book, maybe I should send it to you one time. Just read the villain part. I mean, the villain is one of the creepiest villains you'll ever see in a book. So, you know, I just get tired. I mean, I see the same things coming over. I see, you know, Dale Brown and, like I said, Brad Taylor and Brad Thor and David Baldacci, and I'm just like, oh, my, another freaking FBI, CIA, NSA, terrorist group going around the world. How many times can they try to blow out freaking Afghanistan and fail? I'm like, oh, my God, just blow the freaking country up already and go someplace else, you know?
Well, then here's a question for you, and this is for people listening, too. What do you want to see right now?
You know, that's a good question. You scare me sometimes. And the one thing that I think, since it's Halloween, you know, we'll kind of go in. I like to see more psychological thriller suspense books than a cookie-cutter mystery thing. I guess I would more like to see stuff like what old Dean Koontz would do, or what Harlan Coben, you know, Joseph Fender, you know, the ordinary people, shit happens to them, because then it's not like they can pull out their Glock and nail somebody from 100 yards away, center breast, 3 shots, boom, 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 done. I mean, it's like such a cop-out. I kind of like knowing that the character is nervous and scared and not Billy Badass that can take everybody out like Arnold Schwarzenegger in Commando, killing 150 people and never getting a scratch. So I like knowing that. I like those books better. I like knowing that the character is struggling and seeing how they're going to get out of it. Because it's almost like, how would I get out of it? Because they're like me. You know, what would I do? I mean, you know, you're not an FBI guy, right? And I'm not an FBI guy. And I've not been specially trained in special, you know, Delta Force, Green Beret, Special Forces, and this and that. But if someone were to steal my daughter, how would I react? I wouldn't know what to do. I'm not fucking Liam Neeson and Taken. You know, I'm not like that. So what would I do? I can't call somebody up. I just can't go and go to the supercomputer and start figuring out which terrorist group took them. I would go freaking crazy. My head would be spinning. I would be in a cocoon in the floor for a month. I wouldn't know what to do. And that's what I think, and that's what I would like. That's what I want to see. I want to see things that I can relate to, because I cannot relate to guys, like I said, that can shoot center breast with a Glock 9mm in the fall, can barely see. All of a sudden, the guy lights a cigarette and he goes bam, 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 and then shoots the guy three shots dead in the chest because he lit a cigarette from a mile away and the sniper nailed him in the head. I can't get that, dude. I just can't get that. So what about you? I mean, what do you think? I mean, you know, if you want to react to what I said, but what do you think?
Actually, I kind of in the same, I agree with you. I really like characters that I feel like I can relate to. And as I'm reading it, I would question, would I do this in this situation? What would I do? And
yeah,
you're absolutely right. I'm not Liam Neeson either. And if my daughter were kidnapped, I would be concerned, obviously, but I would be a basket case. I wouldn't know what to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, no one's going
like,
to do that.
If anybody knows what we look like and sees us, they really know that we're not CLT material. So let's just get that out of the way right now.
that's true. Though they did ask. Anyway, I turned them down.
What? Oh, what? What did they need somebody to get water for them? Hey, dude, will you answer the phone while we're off chasing terrorists? We need somebody to be our answering machine. Hey, I got that covered.
Yeah, we need some more bagels.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah, but I really like especially the novels that really look at sort of suburbia and the taking a look at people who could be your next-door neighbors and looking at secrets. You know, everybody's got secrets. Everybody's got something going on. And, you know, some secrets are, you know, like, ooh, you know, he secretly likes to collect something or, you know, maybe it's human hearts or something. I don't know. But those, to me, are the most fascinating because when you're reading him, you think, man, this guy reminds me of my next-door neighbor, and I'm a little freaked out now.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and I think of Lisa Gardner, too. I really like her stuff. The deep psychological, and she doesn't rely on a lot of what seems to be a trend lately is the amnesia. Have you noticed that?
Yeah.
Ah, good grief. I don't think I've known anybody who's ever had amnesia. Have you?
I'm sorry. Who are you again?
Exactly.
Yeah. No, I've never known anybody that's had actual, like, amnesia for like quite a bit of time. I mean, playing football, I did know people that legitimately, you know, they got their bell rung and they didn't really know where they were at that time. But I've never met anybody that ever had like total amnesia and literally forgot everything. No, I've never done that.
Yeah, and that just sort of seems to be the trend lately with some suspense novels, and it's kind of confusing to me and not believable.
Well, you know, and here's the thing, and I was talking to Alexandra Sokolov, and, you know, she was at the place because she is, her partner is Craig Robertson, and they live in Scotland, and they kind of go back and forth, so that's why she was there. She spoke. She has a great class that she does. If you ever want to check out her book, one of her books called Huntress Moon, she's looking to, might be on the movie screen soon. Not won't be feature film, but it could be like DVD or something like that. She's great. And where the hell was I going with this?
It's your amnesia.
What was the question? No, legitimately, I just freaking got it. But I was talking with her. Oh, we were talking about, that's right, because she was saying, a screenwriter, and she was saying that right now, there's legitimately, like, Hollywood has, like, no original ideas. There's, like, nothing going on. I mean, there's just nothing. They have no original ideas. And it's like books are trying to turn to the same thing. It's kind of like the ideas are kind of getting lost somewhere. It's almost like the big publishers are so worried about their profits that they are just throwing out the same book with a different cover almost every single time. And it's not, I mean, I get the emails, you get the emails from the publicists. And it's like, you know, I get the 50 to 60 a day with this book is coming out, and we want you to interview this person, and we'd love you to read this book. And but then when I start reading the premise, it's like every there's like five premises, and they all fall within those five. It's like nothing that I haven't read. It's like, yeah, the last email that was just sent was the same thing from some other freaking publisher. It was about the same exact freaking book. So my question is, do you think that we might have lost a little of the golden age of writing, and we are in such a funk right now that this is just what we got?
No. I think that it's all about cycles. If you'd said 2 years ago, oh, good grief, how many vampire books are we going to see? You know, we are at the tail end of that, and now it's something else. You know, might be zombies, might be this whole amnesia thing we were talking about, might be the military. It does go through cycles, and it usually takes somebody to take a chance on something, and it just finds the right timing and the right pulse and the right market, and readers just flock to it, and there's no explanation for it. Look at Girl on a Train. That was this year's huge book. Who would have thought? You know? And yeah, what is it going to be next time? You know, look at Gone Girl. You know, we talked about that's another one that I know that's one of your favorites. But
yeah, right.
Yeah, you just never know. And the problem is, I think some publishers, they have a vision of, okay, here's what sells. I need to look at that. That works. Now I need to find other books like that. So if I write a book about a British woman who likes to ride a train, I might have a shot at publishing it. I wouldn't want to write it, but
I mean, that's the thing, and we know when we talk about all the time too, is if you're following a trend, you're already too late.
Right. Absolutely, because let's say tomorrow I sell a book, it's not going to come out for 2 years.
Yeah, I don't think people realize that. I don't think people legitimately realize that if you sold a book today, if your agent sold your book today, you would probably not come out until sometime in 2017.
Yeah, the publishers already have their schedule set for most of 2016 already, right now.
Yeah. I mean, because if you go on Amazon and you look at new releases, I mean, there's new releases that are out right now going through April, May, June. I'm starting to see books coming through that are coming out in June.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, if you're going to try to chase a trend, you're already too late.
Right, and that's why I always tell folks when I go to conferences and things like that, write what you want to write about. Write what you're passionate about. Don't follow trends because, yeah, you're already too late.
You know, and if what you're passionate about happens to be vampires or something like that, just put another spin on it. I mean, you know, just try to do something a little different. You know, try to be a little bit, you know, but you need to write your own book. And if you're a fan of Stephanie Meyer or Anne Rice or, you know, Stephen King or Dean Koontz, don't try to emulate what they do because then it's not really you. You need to write, you can have them as a mentor. Like, I like their style and I like the way they put a story together, but you need to write what's in your heart. So us as a reader feel that.
Right, and the best books you can tell. You can absolutely
you can
tell
when they come. Yeah, when they come from the heart, without a doubt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, obviously, Lincoln's not going to come on.
I'm sorry about that. He would have been fun to chat with. I will see
getting
him back on. Maybe with Doug, we'll see.
We'll get him back on. So why don't we do this? We're going to have a little topic. Let's have a little fun, because Halloween just passed. So let's talk
about... you got some candy for me?
Well, yeah, but how are you going to get it? You're in Seattle. I'm in L.A.
Well, we'll work on it.
Okay, that's good. We'll do it next time.
Okay. Yeah, sounds good.
So why don't we talk a little bit about horror? And what did you your favorite kind of Halloween movies that you like to watch, like right around this time? like either leading up to or a little bit after? You know, is there like some kind of go-to thing that you that you like to go to?
There's two for me.
I swear to God, if you say Charlie Brown and the Pumpkin Patch, I'm hanging up on you.
No, actually. So first one is, it's the great, no, I'm kidding. I love watching the really psychological and scary episodes of The Twilight Zone. With
oh.
the black and white, there's some of those that are just, they still resonate. And getting to watch with my kids now who are, you know, just starting to understand how great that show was and how influential it was to a lot of people. It's nice
yeah.
to share that with them. And so that was one we did. And then my daughter, I had never seen it. I don't know why I had never seen it. But my daughter and I finally sat down and watched Nightmare Before Christmas.
Really? You had never seen that before?
I've done the ride at Disneyland. I've heard the music. And,
with
you know,
Jack.
I've seen most of Tim Burton's stuff. But, yeah, this I'd never seen it. And I pretty much knew the story already, but yeah, it was fun.
It's a hey, it's a cute little movie. It's really good. You know,
yeah,
I mean,
I would say Corpse Bride is better. If you haven't seen that one, I would recommend that highly. In fact, my daughter watched that after we finished watching Nightmare Before Christmas.
You know,
very similar animation style.
You know, you're a little bit more tame than I am, I guess, with my horror movies. I mean, I grew up, I mean, this is me, okay. I mean, I grew up in 1978, 78, 79. I was 8, I think I was 8, 9 years old, and I saw Halloween in the movie theaters. I saw Amityville Horror when I was under 10 years old in the movie theaters. I saw, you know, Salem's Lot, which scared the death out of me when that freaking guy opens his eyes and then he's like, ugh, you know, scared the disease.
I saw Alien in the theater when I was a kid. Yep.
Yeah, and those movies. Now, you know, I mean, I always watch the Halloween. Love the Halloween movies. I mean, it's funny because every time I see the original Halloween, I got the 25th anniversary DVD where they showed the behind the scenes. And a lot of people might not know this, and I'll give you a little history of the movie Halloween. If you have not seen that, first of all, it was filmed in Pasadena, on a street in Pasadena. So it was, had nothing to do with the Midwest. When you watch the movie again, especially at the beginning parts, when they're in the town, you know, like the day of trick-or-treat, if you watch closely, first of all, you're going to see palm trees in three different shots. They didn't have palm trees in Illinois, okay? But he couldn't get it out of the shot, so it's there. If you see it, you see it. If you don't, you don't. The other thing you're going to notice is that every single tree has green leaves, except there's leaves that are blowing across the street, and they look like they had fallen from the fall. Well, that's because he had to go get a bunch of those leaves and put them into bags. And off camera, which you could not see, is there is a fan, and they would take the leaves and blow them across the shot. And then they would say cut, and then everybody would have to go get the bags and pick up the leaves, put them back in the bag so they could do it for the next shot. So that's kind of funny. The other thing is that Jamie Lee Curtis thought that she was going to be fired after the first day. And she thought she was horrible, this and that. John Carpenter called her up and said, so how do you think it went? And she's like, you know, she was just kind of lost for words. He goes, I thought you were wonderful. I thought it was great. And that kind of let her go. So Carpenter kind of gave her the confidence to keep going. The other thing is that he only had $200,000 for this movie. This movie was made on $200,000.
That's just amazing.
He went $20,000 over because he had to pay Donald Pleasance a bonus to get him to be in the movie. Of course, he's Dr. Loomis. Also, everybody also knows that Michael Myers, his mask is William Shatner. I mean, that's pretty
Yes, of course. Yes.
But what you didn't know maybe is that there's two Michael Myers as adults in that movie. There is the one guy who always wears the mask, and he is called, and he's actually called the Shape. If you look at the credits, they just call him The Shape. Okay, he's not called Michael. It's called The Shape. Only young Michael Myers, I think, is actually credited with saying Michael Myers. So he's called The Shape. That guy was a friend of John Carpenter's who said, dude, I know you're doing this movie. I just want to help. What can I do to help? Carpenter said, wear that mask, wear that thing, walk around and be scared. And that was him. The other time you see Michael is at the very end when Jamie Lee Curtis pulls the mask off of his face and you see his face. That guy was only in that shot. He was not Michael at any other time. He was the only time he was in that shot was that time when he played Myers. The other time it was the other guy. He did the other stuff.
Man, okay.
And hold on, I got more because PJ Souls, who's in the movie, do you remember PJ Souls? She's the girl who kept saying totally, totally, totally the whole time. She was like the cheerleader.
She was in Stripes, I remember, too, yeah.
She was married. I think it was, she was either married, engaged, but she was going out with, and she wanted her, I think it was, I believe they were married, and she wanted him to be in the movie. But he couldn't be in the movie because he was doing another movie at the time called Dreamscape, and that was Dennis Quaid. And so he was almost in Halloween because he was with PJ Souls. And he was not able to make it because he did the movie Dreamscape, which was another great horror movie. If people haven't seen that with Max von Sydow, I thought that was a good movie. So that's probably so much more than you ever need to know about Halloween.
Well,
and I'm like one of those stupid connoisseurs of the movie. But if you ask me a question, I probably don't.
Well, see, the thing I like about, I don't like a lot of gore. That's what turns me off a lot of the horror, you know,
exactly.
Song and all that stuff.
I hate gore.
I like Halloween. There's no gore in it at all. But what did they have
and
to
you know
do?
Why you know why
they had
no
to make all those
gore?
Lousy sequels.
But well, yeah. But you know why there's no blood in the first Halloween?
Because they couldn't afford it.
Exactly. He had no budget for blood.
It works.
So the only time you see any kind of blood is when he puts Annie on the bed and puts the Judas Myers thing behind her, there's a little bit of blood there on her. That's it. It's the only time you see blood. You don't see blood any other time. But Halloween 2, oh, and the other thing too, Deborah Hill is one of the producers of that movie with John Carpenter, and you'll see Deborah Hill's done a lot of stuff with John Carpenter. When
right.
you see Michael Myers stabbing his sister at the very beginning of the movie, that hand is actually Deborah Hill. She's doing that motion because her hands are so small that it works. So that's actually her hand. She's actually doing that.
Okay.
That's kind of funny, too. Yeah, I mean, but there's no gore in that movie. It's literally the soundtrack and him walking around and seeing it. I mean, that's the same thing with Jaws. That's the same thing, you know. I mean, Friday the 13th has that little bit about, but as far as the sequels and Halloween, I actually didn't mind them because I thought they were all pretty interesting, so I really didn't mind them too much. The third one was a little off-kilter, but that's because it had nothing to do with Michael Myers. It was something totally different. But if you watch the first and second back-to-back, it's generally one giant movie because it all happens on the same day. A lot of people don't realize that. Then it's actually the same exact day. That happens because she goes to the hospital and he continues to follow her. So she's still going on that whole night is him following her in one flicking day. That's one day of those two movies together.
I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's pretty cool. If you watch them back to back and just keep them rolling, then you'll just see one gigantic movie. But yeah, then when they started doing 4 and 5, but it was cool when Jamie Lee Curtis came back. And then that she was the headmistress of that school, and he came after her. And then she finally ends up dying in the one after one with Busta Rhymes when he goes to the house in Resurrection. I know way too much about this stuff. That's why I love it. And I love it because horror has no rules. You can kind of do whatever you want. You can scare the hell out of people and make it fun. And that's what it is. And it was just what you were talking about. It's set in a small town, it's in the suburbs, it's in the Midwest, it can happen to anybody, and you have no idea who your neighbor is next door, some 8-year-old little boy killing his sister, turning into that guy.
Yep.
And that's what it makes it, man.
And the music is great too. I was going to ask you, because we got a couple minutes left. Top of your head, scariest movie you've ever seen?
Wow, scariest movie I've ever seen.
While you think about it, I'll tell you mine.
What is it?
The Exorcist. And I'll tell you why. A friend of mine, I was 8, convinced me to go see this movie with him. And he said, you know, oh, dude, I'm so ready for this movie. And we go in and we sit down. And 15 minutes in, there's a scene where, like, there's banging at the ceiling. And he looks at me and he goes, I'm out. And he leaves. And I'm in the theater by myself. And I'm like, oh, crap. I watched that movie, but I was terrified the whole time. I thought, dude, you left me alone in here.
I would have to say, because of my age, and I'll be quick, was Amityville 4. Because I was 8, 9 years old when I saw that in the movie theaters. And when I came home, every little creak or something, I thought my freaking house was haunted. And it was almost, and this is no joke, where our apartment was, is that the bathroom downstairs was right next to the basement door. So you had to, you know, you go into the bathroom. Well, there was times when I was home alone, and it was, you know, like 7:30, 8 o'clock before my mom came home from whatever she was doing. I would run to the bathroom because I was afraid that something was going to come out of that basement door and grab me and take me down. So when I would go to the bathroom, I would literally open the bathroom door and stand back and see if anything was going to come before I ran out to the couch. And there was no way in hell I would ever go upstairs to my room to grab anything. That was not happening. No way, no how, no thing. No. That scared me so much because every little creak, I thought the house was alive. And I thought, and no. And, of course, it didn't help when I was watching Halloween and Friday the 13th and part of 2. But that scared me because the house was the problem and you couldn't get away from it. I mean, that was the thing that got you, because you had to live, you know. That was the thing that got me the most, was that one.
Okay.
So, yeah. That Salem's Lot scared the shit out of me, too. I ain't going to lie about that. But they all got me when I was younger. Now when I'm a little older, I mean, you can kind of, you know, they say the word cut, everybody gets up and walks away. But I didn't know that at the time. So, all right, man. It's been a great show. We've had a lot of fun talking. We haven't had a show like this where we just talked and talked, and hopefully people enjoyed it. If you didn't, well, there's always other ones you can listen to, and there's back ones, too. But sometimes, you know, it's just get a show like this.
Well, yeah. Well, sorry again, Lincoln didn't show, but it's been fun. Thanks. And we'll be back in a couple weeks.
And I could have really spoiled the pot and said, you know what, instead of that, I'm going to play the Kathy Reichs interview that I have here up that's on Crime and Science Radio, which is coming up soon. I think Doug and Jan would have been a little pissed if I did that one.
Yeah, we don't want you to do that.
This is for you.
Oh, thank you.
And on that
it's
note,
been a pleasure.
And on that note, we will see you all next time. Sweet dreams, Jeff. Have a lovely one.